Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking new ministers, new UCAS numbers, cheating and academic governance. It's all coming up.
Arguably, there was a time when we needed to test someone's ability to regurgitate knowledge because we didn't live in a hyper-connected world and we did need to memorise information. But I think we can probably afford to be more outputs focused, right? I mean, I saw some commentary, I think was sort of pearl clutching, really, about remote online exams and the inability to monitor how students were completing them. And like, Mark, you know, I...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to dive into the HE policy waters this week in what is unbelievably the final episode of this season and this academic year, three fabulous guests as always. Just outside Chepstow, it's Jenny Shaw, Higher Education External Engagement Director at Unite Students. Jenny, your highlight of the week and the academic year.
Oh gosh. So they're both research related. So this year I've just got the data set back from our applicant survey and really just been getting under the skin of this new cohort that's coming in. So that's been really exciting. Highlight of the year has to be the Living Black at University research that we launched. And that's because how much it's given people a voice. So black students and black staff as well. That's been absolutely my highlight of the year.
That's a great, great piece of work. I commend it to listeners. On the border of Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire, it's Ash Cardia, Director of Planning, Legal and Governance Services at the University of Leicester. Ash, your highlight of the week and year, please.
Hi, Mark. Thank you. So I'd say graduations are starting this week at the university, and it's a wonderful reminder for me as to why I love the transformative nature of our sector. It looks like it's going to be a hot week for those who are graduating, so please stay hydrated, listeners. Personal highlight for me is that it's sports day in my children's school, and I'm really not looking forward to the parents' race at the end. And then I think in terms of the highlight of the year, I'm glad we're starting to finally kind of transition out of COVID. I know we're still a long way left yet, but that's one. And then the other is a shameless plug for the university, and it was that I think it's been the year of the ref, and we've gone up 23 places at the University of Leicester to rank 30th overall, so it's given a real feel-good factor to all at the university.
Great. And in Exeter, it's Sunday Blake, Wonky's Associate Editor. Sunday, your highlight of the week and the year, if you please.
So my highlight of the week is being added to the community WhatsApp group, which is really exciting because when you're a graduate and you stay in a university city that all your friends move out of, you kind of don't really know people, and it takes a while to like integrate into like the community. So being added to that, I feel like I've kind of like become like a local, if that makes sense, rather than a graduate. And my highlight of the year, at risk of sounding like a sycophant and having some anonymous Twitter account call me a bootlicker, is coming to work for Wonky, obviously, which has just been the best thing I've ever done. And have, you know, the whole year, there's not been one dull moment, which is incredible to say.
Well done for reading that script out so perfectly, Sunday.
I haven't got a script.
Excellent. Now, we start the week with politics. And they say a week is a long time in politics. So it has been the last one, and so it will be the next one, probably. Ash, talk us through what on earth is going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a new HE minister, and we've got the race for being the leader of the Conservative Party and potentially the new next Prime Minister. So that new Minister for Skills, Further and Higher Education at the Department for Education is Andrea Jenkins. And so let's hope we don't get any obscene gestures towards the sector like the crowd got from Andrea last week outside of Downing Street. David Kernahan has provided some like really fascinating insight into the new minister on the Wonky website. So I just literally lifted all the stuff that I could find from there. In terms of the Tory leadership race, we'll know more in the coming days, obviously, as to who the final two candidates will be. And it's going to be a month, I'm sure, of intense canvassing. From a kind of a non-partisan perspective, it's great to see a diverse group of candidates vying to be the next leader and the next prime minister.
Great. So Jenny, what jumped out at you at the profile of Andrea Jenkins?
Well, I was very struck by DK's analysis of her previous amateur music career. As you know, I love an amateur musician, and I hope that means that she's going to protect creative arts courses.
Well, she was. She did have a hit single in Pakistan in 2008. I believe we've got a clip. So this is possibly a first, a HE minister with a somewhat of a musical career backdrop. I guess it definitely makes the choices we play, you know, the music we pipe in at the start of wonky conferences, that's kind of taken care of for now, I think. But on a serious point, I mean, she is a very hardline Brexiteer, and she's also a kind of extreme Johnson loyalist. An odd choice for an HE minister then, Sunday, right?
Well, I actually don't think it's the worst thing in the world to have a universities minister who went to university via a non-traditional route and as a mature student, particularly as the last two universities ministers have had a tendency to treat campuses like sort of boarding schools or students as school leavers. So, I will admit there are some strange qualities to her as an individual, but I'm interested to see where she comes with that non-traditional perspective.
Yeah, so this was said, I mean, there's something similar was said about Gavin Williamson, who went to University of Bradford, because previously, we, you know, I mean, as politics is so dominated by Oxbridge graduates, it is always stand out when you get a minister who didn't take that route. So that is interesting. Hopefully that gives her, as you say, kind of a more breadth of understanding of the different sorts of higher education there is. But I mean, it's going to be a difficult summer, right? Actually, we've got A-level results. We've got all sorts on the agenda. I mean, it's more than just a caretaker job. I mean, she's going to have to get properly stuck in, right?
Yeah, I think so. But what will be interesting will be, you know, we should have a sweepstake on this, Mark, really, as to how long either she'll be in post once the new minister, prime minister is announced. And, you know, maybe you should do a sweepstake on Wonky as to how long the next minister will be in post, given how things have been so turbulent recently. There is a lot on the agenda. I know that was covered in last week's podcast as well. But I think that we've got a number of things that we just do need to consider. I also don't think she'll want to rock the boat too much, but that's just my naive perspective. There is a hell of a lot going on with regards to the lifelong learning entitlement and obviously the freedom of speech bill that's going to be coming through. Part of me actually thinks how much damage can be done in the next few weeks or months.
Yeah, so the government has said that they're not going to change any policy. They're going to kind of carry on with what they're already doing and what's in train. So as you said, that means free speech bill, that means consultations on lifelong learning entitlement, minimum eligibility requirements, student number controls, all of that is probably going to carry over and kind of tick over. I guess the question is, you know, I mean, as Chris Husband said this week, you're somewhere out there in the sector, you know, a vice chancellor's office is getting a call about a visit because, you know, Andrew Jenkins will want to kind of get on the road and, you know, have some pictures in front of a university. I guess the question is, you know, who will get her attention, who will get, who will be influential with her, and whether she keeps Ian Mansfield as a special advisor is also kind of pretty key because he's got lots of relationships in the sector. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch in the next few weeks, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be an interesting one. And I think one of the things I've always thought about ministers and new ministers coming in is, and you'll know more about this, Mark, than in your kind of previous experiences. Surely we should be utilising some of the experience of previous ministers in terms of mentoring and supporting new ministers that are coming into a sector. We've had some, you know, very, very interesting characters responsible for our sector in the past. I'm sure, you know, within their same party. So I'm sure they could call upon their experience. But how realistic is that? Is that something that could happen?
Good question. And so, we're, you know, we've got loads of hustings going on for leader of the Conservative Party. We're heading towards final two candidates, and there's going to be an awful lot of these things happening over the summer. If you were going to go along to one of those, and maybe you will, What would be the question you would ask those candidates?
So I feel quite passionate about this, and that's free school meals for all school children or children of a school age, from all the way through from primary, secondary, and then wherever the special schools are as well, etc. Just to make sure that every child is fed. I did a back of the envelope calculation as to how many billions it might cost, and it would cost quite a lot, but I think given everything that we've got going on, one of the questions I would ask is, you know, would you be willing to consider that? Yes, the question would be, how would we pay for it? But, you know, if that's through increased taxes, et cetera, but that's certainly something that I would want to have considered.
You know what? I'm just going to pile on that point. I think there's nothing more fundamental than that. And I think then, you know, we might want to extend that and talk about, okay, how are you going to address the dwindling of the value of the student maintenance package in a high inflation economy, and how are you going to address food poverty among students as well?
Sunday, what would be your questions to the candidates?
I was also going to say cost of living issue, but not just for students, but just for the general population. But to throw in something else, I do, one of the things that I've seen come out of a lot of the Tory leadership debate, which is exhausting because it's been going on for quite a few years now in education, but it's, you know, this idea of the culture wars, right? And you've seen like the attacks on Advanced HE, the attacks on trans rights, and the thing is, I do think that young people can be slightly intolerant. They can run away with certain ideologies when they're at university, because that's part of going and experimenting on who you are and your beliefs. But what I want to see is a candidate who's not coming out swinging and fighting in the culture wars, but someone who's actually going to end it, right? I mean, it's called a war, right? We want someone who needs to end a war. And I think one of the things I'm not seeing in the candidates is someone who can approach this issue, who's calm, level-headed, and can actually like calm down a very divisive tension that is, you know, that the sector's bearing the brunt of at the minute. So, yeah, obviously I would put cost of living above that. But as everyone else has said things around cost of living, I would like to see someone actually come out and say, this is an issue going on at the minute and this is how I'm going to end it, rather than just like fan the flames, which I think a lot of people are doing, or a lot of the candidates are doing.
And just some sense of where they see universities like in the world, you know. I mean, it's been really popular for Conservative ministers to talk about there being, you know, too many students essentially, and emphasizing other routes. But I think they are going to have to be pressed on, you know, what they want from the higher education system, how big it should be, and whether, you know, they're happy to continue squeezing it as they are in funding. I think it'd be a shame if it doesn't come up in Hustings. Maybe I'll pop along as well to ask a question. Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, Alex Blower here, Access and Participation Manager for Arts University Bournemouth. This week I've been writing for OneKey on the subject of educational attainment and higher education progression for working class boys. The blog takes a look at discussions that have taken place across the higher education sector over the last few years and asks the question, why, after so much discussion, there is so little action taking place to address the issue. It presents recent developments in access and participation plan strategy from the OFS as an opportunity to make meaningful impact for working class boys, and the blog constitutes a call to action collectively for the higher education sector to mobilise behind the issue and address it.
Now, we're getting many more numbers out of this year's UCAS application cycle. Jenny, walk us through them.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So, as you say, UCAS have dropped their data on the 30th of June deadline applicants in the current application cycle. As a veteran of many a widening participation initiative, it's a bit of a dream come true for me, because we've got record numbers of applicants this year from those most deprived areas, the polar quintile one areas, and application gaps have narrowed between the most advantaged and the most disadvantaged areas. But it's quite bittersweet at the same time, because there is going to be a fierce competition for actual places. So we don't have student number caps. That's fortunately been ruled out for now. But there is that capped unit of resource that's dwindling in real terms, and it means there's less incentive, of course, for institutions to expand their UK student numbers. So, in other words, what we're seeing at the applicant stage might not translate into a more equitable participation rate. And then we've got the cost of living crisis. We've talked about that already, but for students, and especially those without parents who can help them out financially, they're going to be really vulnerable. So the total student finance package is not at all keeping up with inflation, and nor is it likely to do in the near future unless something changes. So in summary, although we're moving towards equality of opportunity when it comes to participation, we're still a long way from equality of outcomes.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like a real tragedy to me. I mean, all this work for so many years in widening participation, get people to university, and we're heading to a point where universities essentially can't afford to teach them. This is going to be a political problem this summer. We've been predicting this on Wonky for a while. So, I mean, outside of just this year, I mean, application rates have been rising, demand continues to increase, and the overall amount of 18-year-olds continue to rise. And this year, more than ever, we're starting to see really noticeable moves in universities having to prioritise or deciding to prioritise international students rather than home students when it comes to just trying to make the numbers add up. And I just feel like we're heading towards this massive, massive crunch point. It may not come this year, but that gulf between the amount of people who want to go and the amount of spaces that there are, it just feels like, I mean, all that work to get to this point is going up in smoke. Sorry, more of a comment than a question. Someone else put out my misery. What's the good in all this?
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I'm pretty sure that we had the exact same headline for this back in January, that, you know, record number of students are applying to universities. So it, you know, it shouldn't really come as a surprise. I think what disappointed me this morning, when I was sort of going through the different press releases from, you know, UK and Office for Students around this, and there was just purely celebratory around this, and I really feel that it's a kind of it's like a veneer, you know, it's like a sort of like, hey, isn't this great that these students are, you know, this a record number of disadvantaged students are going to university. I completely agree with Jenny. I'm not sure it is, and the other thing that I was a little concerned about in the Standard, I think it was yesterday, was there was an article on Kemi Badenoch, who said that she wanted to cut student grants and subsidiaries. I can't remember what, I think she said that was in response to the economic crisis, which made me laugh a little bit, because I don't think that those things are particularly well funded as they are, but you know, especially not not in any way that's going to solve any kind of economic crisis, at least by cutting them. But yeah, it did worry me that those are the conversations that are happening with prime ministerial candidates at the time that record number of disadvantaged students are coming to universities.
They're not coming. It's applications. It's not
sorry,
going, it's not coming.
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, so, no, I've applied.
Ash,
yeah.
Yeah. So Ash, this is good news, but in a vacuum, right? So it's good news that the work to get disadvantaged students into university or to apply to university is working. And it's good news that demand for higher education is strong, because that's good news for the sector overall. It strengthens the sector's position when it comes to negotiating with the Treasury and all sorts of things, right? But it's bad news because not all the students are going to get to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there, in terms of the demand, I think there is still enough availability to meet that demand. Let's see how things go in terms of the different types of provisional offerings that the political landscape is trying to offer with regards to T-levels, apprenticeships, etc. But one of the fundamental questions I think we need to look at here is, are we prepared to support this new cohort of students coming in who have experienced things that none of us have experienced that during their school further education careers to date? So, for example, they're going to be requiring a significant amount of mental health and wellbeing support in terms of the types of assessments that they'll be going through at university, the types of critical thinking, for example. Have we as a sector looked inwards and thought, are we doing the best that we can to support these students? And I'm not suggesting we haven't, but I think we do need to ask that question. I think we do need to make sure that we are setting these students up for success, not failure.
Yeah, so we've just got the data back, as I said, for our applicant survey. It's quite comprehensive. We've got a lot of detail on their mental health and their well-being. We've got a lot of detail about how they feel about their their learning, how they feel about social issues and so on. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that hopefully next week. I think it will give us a real deep dive into what this current this incoming cohort is going to want and need. And it is quite different. Just a little spoiler there.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing that very much. You can find all the UCAS data and everything else you need to know about what's going on in links in the show notes. Now, our colleague from Wonky, James Coe, is here to tell us what's going on with research allocations and everything else.
Hi, it's James here, Associate Editor for Research and Innovation. It has been another busy couple of weeks on the science policy front. Of course, the government has fallen as the Conservative leadership election rumbles on. There is a gap at the heart of science policy with the departure of George Freeman. In a set of unusual tweets, George Freeman was saying he would come back to his role, and then he confirmed that in fact his offer had been declined. In the meantime, it seems that Kwesi Kwarteng is going to oversee that portfolio, but of course that leaves a day-to-day gap at the heart of this policy. This is unhelpful as issues like Horizon Association remain on a knife edge, and at the moment, association looks more unlikely. However, amidst all of this uncertainty, Research England yesterday released their 2022 to 2025 budget. And it has a lot of good news in it for the sector. QR funding is up, there is additional funding for knowledge exchange, and there are more incentives around business collaboration. The funding formula is similar to previous years, with the links between three-star and four-star research maintained. Funding is falling proportionately to disciplines, as it has previously, and there is even a specific mention of the value that arts and humanities bring to our shared cultural lives. No doubt a nod to some of the speculation that actually these things are somehow less valuable or should be defended, as you will hear from lots of misinformed media commentators. At a time where everything may feel a bit loose, where there is a sense that science policy can be forgotten about amidst the wider chaos of government, a medium-term funding settlement that has increased quantum of funding to it brings a sense of certainty where the sector needs it most, and it can get on with the things which we are best at, pushing the boundaries of human knowledge in order to improve the lives of all of those we encounter.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, there's some interesting new polling out about students cheating in exams. Sunday, walk us through it, please.
Okay, so this is actually a survey which was commissioned by the law group Alpha Academic Appeals, which I love the name of, and it found that 16% of students say that they have cheated in online exams this academic year, but only a very small minority of those who cheated got caught. 50% of respondents knew someone else who had cheated, and 8 in 10 believed that it was easier to cheat in online exams than exam halls. So obviously, you know, with this, there's the typical arguments that can be made when we talk about cheating. So, you know, like conversations around student academic confidence and imposter syndrome, and are institutions adequately preparing students for exams in a way that boosts their morale and their confidence, they feel they don't have to cheat, you know, all those conversations. But I actually don't think that this is so much of a why cheat conversation, a more conversation that we need to look at the reality of the world that we live in and whether the style of assessment used still reflects that. Because obviously, you know, we're being sort of bombarded by ministerial directives that universities must prepare students for the world of work or give them real skills for work, right? And it just made me think about, you know, what is the reality of the world of work? Because what is constituted in this survey as cheating is very much how I work on a daily basis. So when you look at the qualitative input, when they're asking students how they cheated, they said that they used online resources, they discussed questions with a friend, or they completed an assignment collaboratively. Now, myself and thousands of other degree holding workers in the country and the devolved nations, you know, we sit at our desks with an incomprehensible amount of information and secondary knowledge at our fingertips, surrounded by colleagues, well, virtually or physically, who can collaborate and assist with us. And, you know, like when I'm writing an article for the site, I'm in this sort of position. I don't sort of sit and think, oh, what's the specific clause in the Education Act? I'll look them up, or maybe ask Jim because he'll know. But I mean, you know, I've sat in a GP's office before and they've Googled symptoms, or they've nipped out and asked a colleague for advice. And I just think that we've moved past this idea of students having to consume or regurgitate knowledge as for an exam, because one, it's incredibly tedious. It doesn't test critical capacity, and arguably there was a time when we needed to test someone's ability to regurgitate knowledge, because we didn't live in a hyper-connected world and we did need to memorize information. But I think we can probably afford to be more outputs focused, right? I mean, I saw some commentary, what I think was sort of pearl clutching, really, about remote online exams and the inability to monitor how students were completing them. And like, Mark, you know, I work remotely and you don't know what I'm doing for 8 hours a day, but you're happy. Well, I hope you're happy. That might be a conversation for our one-to-ones.
But
do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think it's right to be discussing how we prevent students from working in ways that they're going to be working in for the rest of their lives because of some sort of draconian marriage to exams. What we should be discussing is how do we adequately assess students as being ready for the workplace? And that's not by assessing them in conditions that are the exact polar opposite of those workplaces.
Yeah, I like this angle. I think that's a good angle, Sunday. We're questioning really what we mean by cheating here. So, I mean, and I definitely get everything you're saying, but there is a gulf between, as you say, using digital tools to collaborate and the sort of things that you would expect, and kind of outright plagiarism, which is also not what you're saying is kind of what you would do at Wonky. I mean, I think we would have noticed by now.
Yeah, I think it's the survey. The problem with the survey is it's a very broad definition of cheating. If it's just plagiarism, I would accept it. But, you know, the fact that it's saying speaking to a friend, and I just think, well, I'm not sure that counts as academic misconduct anymore, because, you know, that's what you would do if you're going into the workplace.
Okay. Well, Jenny, maybe help us out here. So, putting aside what is and what isn't academic misconduct, why do students feel like in their minds they have to cheat?
I think there's an intense pressure.
In such large numbers, yeah. I should say. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, they've got so much invested in it, I think, financially compared to previous generations. I mean, I'm saying that as someone who went to university on a full grant and with no fees. So I think that puts a huge amount of pressure on. So it's unsurprising. They want to do the very best they can. But absolutely agree with Sunday. The first thing I thought when I read this was, well, you know, this is just this definition of cheating comes from an era when a small fraction of the population went to university and they were doing so to go on to an academic career. And now that we are seeing, and the government is seeing, university as a preparation for the world of work and the knowledge economy, then it doesn't. That definition of cheating is counter to really what we're demanding of graduates as they enter the workforce. We want them to, as Sunday said, we want them to use all the vast knowledge at their disposal. We want them to talk to people, be collaborative, and to produce things at the end of that. And that's the behaviour that they appear to be showing under this definition of cheating.
Yeah, yeah. How do you handle this, Ash, at Leicester?
So I'd say immediately, personal academic tutoring plays a significant role in trying to cut this off from the start. And I agree with everything that Sunday said and Jenny said, but I think in terms of the ones who are plagiarising and just you know, actively cheating in the worst possible sense. We need to try and get to the bottom of what the reasons are for this. Is the content too difficult? Is it just sheer laziness? What is it that's causing the students to go down this route because of the sheer volumes involved in particular with regards to the survey response? And I think coming back, personal academic tutoring system is for me one of the key drivers to understand the students. How often are they meeting with their academic representatives, other tutors, for example, course leaders, module leaders, etc. We have open door policies, we have office hours, etc. I appreciate during COVID it's been probably virtual and it's not been ideal, but we need to get to a stage where students are able to communicate honestly with all aspects of the university, whether that's through professional services and student support functions or whether that's through the academic teams. I think there's a long way to go. At Leicester, I think we've got a good initiative with regards to personal academic tutors with regards to the kind of early warning signs of engagement or lack of engagement in terms of some attendance monitoring, etc. And then you then look at, well, what interventions are we putting in place? Or are we then, at my earlier point, are we setting them up for failure if we're not helping and supporting them?
I really like that you've made the that really clear distinction between that sort of intentional plagiarism and versus teamwork. I think that was probably missing in my introduction to this. I really like that you made that point. I think that one of the things that I think is, well, because I've been working on this project to do with like belonging and inclusion, and there's a lot of the evidence coming out of that research project is indicating that all the things you said, you know, so really good, strong relationships with academic staff, open door policies, you know, frequent meetings of academic tutors, those lead to students feeling that they are emboldened and part of an academic learning community. And when they feel part of the academic learning community, they feel that they're that they can contribute to that sort of like the institutional knowledge on a topic within their department, and it encourages them and raises their or lowers imposter syndrome and raises their academic confidence in exams. So just really great to hear that you're doing that, because I think that a student who feels part of a learning community is less likely to go to a third party. And, you know, there are a lot of things popping up at the minute, sort of services that, you know, extortionately expensive services offering to complete exams and assignments for students. When a student is embedded in their learning community through the things through the outreach and services that you're talking about, the evidence coming from the work that Wonky and Pearson are doing is showing that they're a lot less likely to cheat because of their raised academic confidence. So, yeah, that's great to hear.
And finally this week, HEPI is out with a new report all about academic governance in universities and what governing bodies need to be doing better. Talk us through it, will you, Ash?
Yeah, thanks. So I really enjoyed reading the HEPI policy note. It's kind of exploring what governing bodies can do in anticipation of the increased regulation and scrutiny surrounding academic standards, quality and student attainment. Putting aside the kind of the questions of autonomy, if I may, that's detailed in the report, and just going straight to the conclusions. Some of the conclusions here are that, you know, they'd look to implement or see some of the following, which is degree outcomes statement, so that kind of an annual consideration of student attainment, what's happened, what's changed, and why has it changed, and then an annual quality report to the governing body that focuses on kind of key performance indicators around NSS, around surveys, whether that's postgraduate, could be internal surveys as well. Summary of key points from external examiners, department action plans, and then specific areas of kind of risk and where they've got some concerns, whether that's either through partnerships, T&E arrangements, etc. Obviously, you've got a link to the TEF, you've got a link to the kind of the regulatory side of things with regards to the conditions, B3 in particular. I've kind of read out all the conclusions there, apologies. And I think they all seem sensible to me. And I suspect that some, if not all, may already be undertaken at a lot of institutions, i.e. I think the governing body will be aware of a lot of these aspects. Just speaking from my experience alone at the institutions I've worked at, I feel confident that these areas were considered even as far back as 6 years ago, actually, in some of the institutions I worked at and continue to be so. I just wanted to add one kind of point around governance, though, and that is just a gentle reminder that most of the governing body lay members aren't paid to carry out their roles, and we ask a lot of them. And so if there's going to be any further increases on their time, are we looking at a change in position where they'll have to be remunerated and therefore a further cost to the sector? So I'm going to leave it there.
I guess one of the interesting things that has clearly happened is, you know, more responsibility for governors and governing bodies over the last few years as regulation has shifted in that direction. And I mean, I recognize the, you know, as a governor of a university myself, I recognize that kind of tension between the kind of academic governance and the rest. And clearly we're heading to a point where it's increasingly hard to separate those two things out. I wonder if that means we need a much bigger think about these structures. You know, you've got, you know, should most universities have a governing kind of council and academic governance structure separately? You know, never the twain shall meet, or do we need to think about these questions much more in the round? Because, you know, it's a kind of unavoidable tension now, isn't it, Jenny?
I think this is a really interesting point. And when I was looking at this, I was reflecting that very, very few people outside of the sector and potentially some people within the sector are not that clear that there is this distinction between governance of academic matters and sort of general governance. Something that I know Nick Hillman, director of HEPI, is fond of saying is universities are not just big schools. They are places where knowledge is created as well as taught. I think there has been a tendency for parts of government to treat universities as if they are sort of big schools, and particularly the whole sort of boots on the ground rhetoric suggests, you know, is that these are entities where that these are really sort of simplistic entities for conveying information to young people, whereas they're not. And I think academic leadership, it does go beyond course quality and academic quality, but I think that's a really important part of it. But is it time to merge the two? I think that feels uncomfortable to me, and I think it will feel uncomfortable for the sector. I think it probably blurs some lines that don't yet need to be blurred.
Yeah, I mean, with senates and councils, that there is a clear distinction between the two. Like, I understand what you're saying about, like, how they're becoming increasingly more like there's crossovers. But so in senates, you know, there are elected staff members from department heads across to hospitality staff and cleaners, right? So it's a really important forum where these you can get this sort of cross institutional voice heard. I think that going back to Ash's point on remuneration of council members, I think that would be something that would concern me a lot. And the point is that, you know, this is meant to be an independent body. It's not meant to be in recipient of payment from the institution that it's governing at all. One thing I am quite happy about with the guests today is I had a question about this, and I think I've got good people to ask, and that is the report seemed to suggest that if governing bodies enhance their understanding of academic life and outwardly demonstrate strong governance in this area, I got the impression that the report was suggesting that this would allow institutions to retain some autonomy in the face of what Jenny was just describing, which, you know, might be slightly heavy-handed sort of heavy-handed interventions from the government. And I wanted to ask, you know, Mark or Ash or Jenny, like, if you think that will happen, because as Ash said, you know, this is something that actually university governing bodies have been thinking about for 6-7 odd years now, and yet, you know, the sort of discourse and discussion that's coming out of government doesn't seem to be paying attention to that. So I didn't know if anyone had any thoughts on that.
So, happy to come in there. I do think that in terms of the kind of the academic quality, the attainment, this information I do think is being presented at the governing body level. And to before I come and answer your question, Sunday, I'm going to answer Mark's one, which is if you put the governing body as the kind of the one that's responsible over, you know, overall responsible for the strategic direction of the institution and then the investment that's allowed to go within that, you tend to want to know whether your investment's paid off or not in terms of the evaluation piece afterwards. So, for example, if you've done a big major refurbishment of building or set up a new building, accommodation blocks, all the way through to digital infrastructure, as well as the physical infrastructure, some of those will kind of, in terms of the approval levels, will be responsible for the executive side of the business. Some of them will be kind of at the council level as the final sign off. But you need to have that assurance that things are working as they were set out to be. And if not, you have the reasons why they aren't working. Mm-hmm. Coming then back to Sunday's question with regards to the autonomy of the institution, I'm worried when you hear a lot of this rhetoric, because I've seen good governance throughout my career. Yes, we've got examples of poor governance practices, but that's where the regulators stepped in and reviewed, and we've been able to have action plans that resolve this quite quickly. Where there is kind of a failing institution that has significant cause for concern, there's probably a handful. If that, I mean, yes, there was a bit of news recently, which I won't name, but we've just got to be careful here, because I think sometimes there's a knee-jerk reaction to a problem that actually doesn't exist, in my opinion, from what I've seen and from what I speak to colleagues in the sector. So I would be worried if there's the kind of the question of institutional autonomy is kind of dangled over as you're lucky to have this, we're going to take it away from you, because I don't see that there's a problem, if I'm really honest.
So that's about it for this week, this season, and this year. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today or throughout the season. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks very much to Ash, Jenny and Sunday, and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen behind the scenes. Until September, stay safe, stay cool, stay wonky.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.